helping the student.
Great. Good morning. Welcome. Thank you all for coming to our transition task force today. We're continuing to try to work through all of the questions that the bill that authorized us asked us to ask. So today we are focusing on students moving on to post-secondary education, both what they need when they get there, what some of the barriers are once they're there in terms of retention, how well we're encouraging students to move on to post-secondary education. We've got people on the agenda, but of course the committee has a lot of expertise around that as well. We're having some bumps in the road in terms of the financial aid for students with modified and extended diplomas. They are eligible, but community colleges are telling them they're not. So we invited some folks from the community colleges to come be part of this, but they aren't here. But we'll talk about it anyway and hopefully continue to create that record, because kids are getting turned away every day, and that's too bad. And then talking about the diverse needs of students and transition populations, which Mr. Boring was bringing to us. So I think we're going to start with what students need to access services at colleges and universities. So we have Martha Smith from OSU, Amy Elber from Clackamas Community College, Melissa Larson from Western Oregon, also from Corvallis, and Lori Fontaine from Willamette. So come on up there, I think. And this has really been, the culture of this group has been pretty informal in terms of the way that we have conversations. And the goal for today is to learn more about what you're seeing when students are coming to you. What kinds of materials would be helpful for them to be bringing with them from high schools? What kind of counseling would be helpful for them as they're coming so they can find you and the services that you're able to provide, and how we can better support students to stay in college? This group ultimately is going to write a series of recommendations that will be shared with agencies in the legislature to see if we need any changes in policy or law or training. And the point of the conversation with you is that you know what's happening and you can help inform those recommendations. So thanks for taking time to come up today.
Thank you.
You get to start.
It sounds like there's been a vote, and yet I wasn't included. Good morning. Thanks for having us. I think we're all pretty excited about this opportunity for this discussion. I'm Melissa Larson from Western Oregon University, and I am pretty passionate about this. I work with a nonprofit to help transition success for high school students and encourage them to dream and think about college, because I think that that's part of it, is that they're not even yet thinking or seeing themselves in that light. And so this is something that I come from voc rehab, I come from mental health, I kind of played and dabbled and ended up back in higher education, which I absolutely adore. I'm not sure where you want us exactly to start, so maybe if you can kind of give us exact kind of like where you would like me to begin, and then I can delve into whatever you want me to.
You want to move kind of chronologically, think about a kid as a junior or sophomore,
sure,
wherever that point is, what they should be thinking about, what barriers you're seeing, what it's like when they're coming to you, if they can get to you.
Okay.
Once they're there.
Sure.
And
I'll,
how to keep
I'll say
them to stay.
Okay, great. I'll say it's reflective of Western Oregon. I think each institution probably sees different things. At Western, I think some of the things that I'm disappointed in are kind of like I would love to see more of is at preview days, which is the days that people go in when I say shop colleges, rarely is my table visited. The Office of Disability Services is rarely visited. And I would make a lot of assumptions about this, but I would say there's twofold. One is, are students with disabilities their junior year making it to college campuses? The second one is, are they then thinking about disability services when they go to college? So I think that that's twofold, and I'm guessing we have a good mix of that. In terms of thinking about their junior year, I don't know everything about the K-12 experience, but I have some experience and knowledge in this area. And what I would say is that what is missing at that point is the student's ability to speak at the level that's appropriate for them about the specifics of their disability. What is their disability? What is it? What is the impacts in the academic environment? And what are their strengths? I don't see students coming into our office being able to speak to what they have to offer and what they're going to do when they go to college. The other thing is the ability to take the responsibility. I would love to see in the transition plan that their junior year, the responsibility responsibility starts to shift towards them. I would love to see that the IEP piece shifts towards them. And I know that it's student-led, but that's very different than a student saying, wait a minute, I need this accommodation, I need to see what this looks like, and starting to get that, kind of get their feet wet in that transition, and no pun intended in that. That piece of when they go to college, we don't reach out for them. We don't say, hey, have you thought about, we think maybe you'd be eligible, have you? We don't recruit in terms of disability services. We're available, we're readily visible, especially at Western. We're across the street from, or across the hall from admissions. But students need to be transitioning in that area. Hey, this is what my disability is. Maybe not even the full diagnosis, but just a sense. And this is how it impacts me at school, and these are the things that are beneficial to me. Sadly, most of the conversations that I have with students when I say, what accommodations do you have in high school, and are they benefiting you, or are you using them? They're like, I don't know, there's a bunch of stuff, but I don't use them. How come? I don't like them. Why? I don't think they're necessary, but that's what they gave me. Or, I've been asking for books in alternative format since I was a freshman, and I still don't have them. That's unacceptable to me. So I'm passionate, so I'll pull it back a little. Students shouldn't have to fight for what's legally theirs. And so that's where I think I do get real frustrated when I'm seeing families who are having to truly fight to get a book in alternative format when there's nonprofit organizations such as Bookshare waiting for people to sign up. It doesn't make any sense to me. So I'd say chronologically, so those are some of the things. The other thing is, making it normalized. It's okay. This is your legal right. Let's make sure you get what you need. Let's get you what you, you know, let's get rolling. So I think those are some of the things that I would love to see students have the capability to do coming out of high school, whether it's going into employment or it's going into a community college or a four-year institution. They need to be able to do so independently. Yes, I love families. Love families. I so want to hear from the student. And I'll frequently ask parents to go, hold on. Wait, I want to hear from your student. And it's okay that they don't know how to do all of that yet. That's what we're here for. But definitely I want students to be able to be that driver of that bus, and that's what I would love to see more often. Boy, I feel like I gave you a lot. So
great, thank you.
Yeah.
I can echo some of Melissa's thoughts. I'm Amy Elber. I'm with Clackamas Community College in Oregon City. And one of the things that I notice, and it's really good to hear these comments because it helps me to see that we're dealing with some of the same issues at the community college that universities are dealing with. But the challenge that I have is that in terms of guidelines around what we're looking for in documentation, those have drastically changed in the last few years, what we're working from with the AHEAD guidelines in terms of documentation. And that's wonderful for our students because we have a little more leeway to work with. But what I'm finding is when I have these guidelines that say, okay, you can work with documentation, student self-report, and common sense, when I have a student that comes that doesn't have any documentation, doesn't know really what their disability is or how it impacts them, and I can't pull any more information out of them, I have to make a decision about what kind of accommodation I'm going to provide this student and if they need an accommodation. And so I echo what Melissa said in that there, I would love to see an opportunity for students to really understand their disability, whether it's understanding their diagnosis and what that means or understanding how their disability impacts them in the classroom, and being comfortable talking about it, being comfortable owning it, being comfortable recognizing it as a part of identity if that is something that they're ready for. I have a disability myself. I wear hearing aids in both ears, and I've had to learn how to make that become part of my identity, not just an impairment. And these are tough questions to be having with high school kids, but I think that there needs to be some thought around, you know, educating students about who they are and helping them be ready to enter college.
I'm Martha Smith. I'm Director of Disability Access Services at Oregon State University. Similar to what my colleagues have said, I think one of the challenges is that I hear a lot from students. About 3/4 of students with disabilities are students that are not visibly disabled. And so what I hear a lot for them is in high school, there were lots of papers sometimes being pulled out to go to the resource room. It was obvious to other kids that they were going to the resource room or something was being done for them. And they come to college and it is an opportunity to blend in and not stand out. And so they do everything they can to, in some ways, create a new identity as a college student. And so maybe while the parents are contacting us, and as Melissa said, we really need to have that conversation with the student. The minute they become enrolled students, because of FERPA, we now are dealing with the students, not the parents. And so the students are like, Mom and Dad are out of the way. I don't have to deal with these people. And so sometimes the next time we see them is because they're in academic probation. And so then they'll come and seek us out. And part of that is normal student development for any college student, sort of like figuring out how does this work and what are the bumps. But there's also a piece of wanting not to be identified. And if you don't have a visible disability, it's really easy to blend in on a college campus. So there's this piece of not going up to the disability services table because I don't want to be one of them. And so there's sort of this catch-22 for students, which is we want them to own who they are, and culturally that still is seen as something bad. Disability identity is not a positive identity for the most part still. And that's not something we can change overnight, but it's something we're dealing with the students coming in. And so how do we have that negotiation of making it okay for students to come and find us? And then once they do find us, that piece of, okay, what's the documentation? What is it that really is going to help you? And really what it comes down to is, do you have information to support the accommodations you're requesting in the higher ed environment? Not what worked for you when you were in third grade, but do you have information that is relevant to this environment? And sometimes that comes from the students themselves, and so if they can't talk about it, that's where that barrier comes. Sometimes it comes from IEPs, but again, if it's just like, well, we gave John, you know, the ability to hand his homework in a day late, so he had a little more time to work on it. It's like that doesn't really give us useful information in terms of what underlying is going on so that we can come up with really good effective accommodations in the higher ed setting. Diagnosis does not equal disability. I think that's the other big misnomer. We have folks who come in and they say, I have a diagnosis, you must then give me A, B, C, and D. And we're like, great, you have a diagnosis, we're not going to deny you have learning disability or ADHD or whatever it is. But tell us, what's the impact for you? Because it's impact that determines accommodation. That's what raises it to the level of disability. A diagnosis in and of itself is not a disability.
I think there's also a little bit of disconnect for students that are especially coming in from high school that, like we were saying, you know, they've been in the special classes or they've been to the resource room and they've been sort of coached through their high school experience and they've been given the tools that they need in the classroom, but then they get to us and they say, well, I was always in the resource room, and so I was told that I should come connect with you. And they don't know what to ask for. And we sometimes can offer them these ideas. And many times I've had students say, oh, yeah, that would... audiobooks would really help me. I always listen to audiobooks at home, and maybe that's not an accommodation that they're used to utilizing in high school. They just don't know what to ask for. And so for us, it's this kind of guessing game of, well, and I don't personally, this is my own philosophy, I don't want to give a student a laundry list of accommodations and say, check the one that you think would help you. I really want to work holistically and individually with the student and figure out what they need for them to be successful. But if I don't have any information from them or from documentation or from the parent or from anywhere else, there's all these resources, but I don't know how to give them to you and if they will help or not. So especially the high schools coming in, high school students transitioning in, helping them understand what's going to be useful for them would be useful for us.
I so agree with Amy on that. And this was a good opportunity for me to review what kind of supports we...
Can you identify yourself for the record?
Sure, yeah. Lori Fontaine from Willamette University. So this helped me take a look at what resources we're providing to students other than the volume of contacts that I received prior to students choosing Willamette. But that what kinds of resources can we offer on our website that students and families can access independently? So I did look at that because, so often once they get to Willamette and they're immersed in this highly rigorous academic curriculum, that whatever tools that they were able to use to be so successful in high school are not adequate. And that's not a really good time for them to add more things to their plate. In some ways it can be ideal because the felt pain can be a good motivator to try some new things. But if they're too complex, then it's just not going to happen. So I would love to see high schools provide the opportunity for students to have some exposure to some of the tools that are available. For example, I have an iPad, and when I was preparing for a presentation, I have to kind of write out a script, and so I can just hit speech on my iPad, and I can listen to it while I'm doing other things. There are just so many easily accessible tools that students can learn about that could make that transition to college provide a little bit easier by providing some new tools. So I did bring some handouts too about preparing for college, and there are some wonderful resources to help people have the opportunity to explore different types of tech resources. Mm-hmm. So there's an organization in Salem called Access Technology Incorporated. Oh, good. So I see some. You nod. So, yeah. And so, do you all know about that? What does Access Technology Incorporated provides? So it's a nonprofit organization, and they have a multitude of different types of assistive technology. They're open to anyone. So I went there with my iPhone and had them help me find apps that can help me with organization. So you don't have to have a disability to use their services. You just have to have a desire to learn about more tech tools. And it's a federally funded program, so they exist in across the country, and then there's a website that you can use to find similar organizations in other parts of the country. So that experience with those simple tools can be really valuable. And then I have a couple of different handouts that Melissa will pass
sure.
around. One is from Landmark College. Yeah.
Perfect.
Landmark College is a nationally recognized college that trains, it's a college for students with disabilities, learning differences, and then they also provide professional guidance, and they have programs that the professionals can participate in to gain more skills and knowledge of serving our students better. But I love this assessment because it's very
simple and clear about the areas that students should be looking at prior to coming to college if they have learning disabilities or other types of disabilities. And then another population that I'm particularly concerned about is students on the autism spectrum. And they're, you know, they can be so strong academically, but maybe just they need a go-to person. So for problem solving often. So, you know, I had one student who just graduated, so excited, because we never thought he would make it. But he just needed a little bit of extra support here and there. So having students on the spectrum who may have difficulty figuring out the social construct of college, making sure that they are encouraged to find that go-to person. So there would be little things like he lost the CDs for a textbook that he needed, and he didn't know it's okay to talk to the professor about that. Or he had a complete meltdown during a test, and I knew that was happening. I called his professor. He was able to go take the test with the professor. I mean, they're just little things that we want students. We can't guarantee that all of those supports will be in place for students with disabilities in a college setting, but find out if they are at their college.
And, you know, I think Lori speaks really well to the piece of we all have a commonality in terms of providing accommodations to students with disabilities because of the culture, size, ethos of the college itself. That might look really differently. I serve over 900 students. So some of the individual care doesn't happen on my campus. That can happen on a Willamette because of its much smaller size, just in general, that faculty-to-student ratio and how those relationships develop. So while we're all committed to that access to serving students, how that plays out can be very different on different campuses because of those resources or size or, you know, what does that dynamic look like in general on that campus?
You know, is that something that someone is talking to students about as they're applying to school and trying to decide where to go? I think that's a common conversation that parents have with kids. Maybe a big campus is good for you, or maybe you would do better on a smaller, more intimate campus. Does that come up specifically for disability?
Go ahead.
Well, one thought, I'm Amy again. I'm at the community college, Clackamas Community College, and I myself, I'm a first generation college student as well. And so as I think about this and as I study it, I remember when I was in school, my parents didn't know really how to direct me, and so my dad took me I lived in Washington. We went to all the schools in Washington. I picked Western Washington University because I liked the library. I didn't know. And it ended up being a really good campus for me, and I got a great education there. But I went to community college first, and that was also a good decision for me, given my disability, given my situation. But for those students, particularly, that don't have parents that know how to guide them in that direction, no, I think that those conversations are not happening at home. For students who do have parents that have been educated, yes, I think the conversations are happening in terms of their disability and where they're going to be comfortable. I don't know. I don't know if there's any way that they can really start to begin to explore different campuses when they're still in high school, other than just taking the initiative to start the visit. If there was a way to do some outreach around that and have those conversations, I know we try to do that as much as we can, and our outreach teams try to do that too. And we try to be honest. You know, we want students to come to our campus, but our campus may not be the perfect campus for that student. So it's sort of informal, though. There's no structure, as far as I know, that's happening around that.
Let's say there are nonprofits that are doing work around this, and I think about the partnership with Insight that we have. We have an institutional partnership with Insight, which is a nonprofit organization that serves holistically individuals with disabilities, not only about higher education, but in general. So they look at from recreation to higher education to independent living, that kind of go across the board. And they are doing these things. They are getting into the high schools. They are bringing high school students to college. I know that they've gone to OSU. They've come to our campus. They've gone to various campuses. So some of that is happening. I guess part of me wants to encourage students to still look at it as you go because you like the library. I mean, that gut feeling. And I always tell students, follow the gut feeling and then follow up to make sure you can get the accommodations and services you need. Because I think it's tough to say, well, look, from this lens, you know, how do you manage that piece? I want people to be stoked about the residence halls or the dining center or the major or the whatever, just like any other student. And so I would love for them to follow the tracks that their peers follow, which is the, I don't know, it felt good when I walked on campus. Oh, and can I get my needs met? I would love that to start being some of the conversation. I will say, too, I would love to see a transition plan for parents.
Yes.
When I'm rich, and I don't know how that's going to work out, or you know, because I don't play the lottery, so I don't think this is ever going to pan out for me. But I think that that's a huge piece, and it's to no disrespect, but the families have fought their whole entire lives for their kiddos' education, and then we're like, peace out, you're 18, so have fun, parents, see you later, thanks for playing. But they're coming in going, okay, so who's going to tell my kid to take their medication? Who's going to call? Oh my gosh.
They call them to make sure.
Yes. We get this, we joke, clearly, if you notice, all three of us had the same joke at the same time at three different institutions. So we really get these conversations, and parents are serious. Like, no, for real. So is the RA going to go like, hey, you need to go to class? Is that an accommodation?
Is that an accommodation?
No.
No. Thank you
not
for clarity. No. But then we go back to, you know, I would love for you, at Junior, who's visiting our campus, to start playing with your iPhone. And do you have a smartphone? And what kind of phone do you have? Hey, I would love for you to start setting an alarm and start practicing taking your medication on your own this next year. And next year, I want you to set your alarm to get up on your own. So I have these little heart-to-hearts. When I get a chance, but the opportunities sometimes aren't there. But the who's going to call my child? My kiddo hasn't called me in a week or two. I'm worried. Okay. So it's those kinds of things. So I would love to see a transition plan for parents, because I still have parents who come to the table. So preview days don't have a lot of students, but boy, do I get a lot of parents. Oh, my kiddo doesn't want to come over. They're over there, and they want, you know, I just want to know what you're going to do to make sure. I'm like, I'm not going to do anything until your kiddo comes over. We can talk to them. They'll be the student, and how do we then do this as a family? And I talk about there's cool opportunities, too. You know, using Google Calendar can, you know, help parents relax a little and yet help students be organized, and how can that happen? So how can you do some of those things with the goal eventually, you know, to not always have the assignments on there so parents can go, okay.
So a theme really sounds like in high school, especially in the second half of high school, really building self-advocacy skills and students and supporting
and
parents
and empowerment and, yeah, absolutely.
And understanding the differences between high school and college. So there are not modifications in college. So fewer assignments, flexible deadlines, flexible attendance, those are, though there can be individual cases, there's no guarantee, and it rarely happens in the college environment.
Ability to retake exams. That's another one that I see a lot in IEPs, is the ability to retake exams or be in a totally different format. And I don't mean like alternative as far as, you know, making sure it's accessible, but I mean, well, this person has ADD, and so they do better with multiple choice.
Instead of
so do I. But that isn't then helping them understand what the expectation is, and when you understanding when you're starting to fundamentally alter.
Yeah. To clarify on that, I think it's a bigger trickle down. You can't turn it on in junior year and say it's. So I'm Brian Agaski. I'm a learning special ed teacher at the high school level at Case Managed 9 through 12. And I think you could have, like, the middle school special ed teacher and the elementary school, and it's such a trickle-down. Like, we say, like, oh, at junior year, we should start turning it on because, hey, it's junior year. The gap starts probably when they're born. you know? And the trickle-down comes all the way to, like, what's going on in kindergarten, first, second, third, when that stigma's developed to go into the resource room, the learning center, the special ed room, the whatever you want to call it, the short bus kind of thing. And so we see that huge bridge gap of, like, I just did an orientation with eighth graders, and I had one kid be like, so does high school, like, do I get a trial period? Do I start freshman year with like a kind of learn to fly week or month or something like that? And then we're at the high school level going, we're real here. Guess what college is really like? And so as we, you know, as you talk and you're like, so where does that conversation begin? It's really got to trickle down. All the, like, transitions is not like a, when they're in eighth grade, we're going to start this cosmic thing. Like it's beginning way, 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 way down there. And the gap every year either widens, or at some point something steps in and starts to close in. And you guys make great points around self-advocacy. I go through those things every day, but it's such a personal thing to be able to articulate that. So
I met with a mom the other day. She has a fourth grader that his only disability is that he uses a wheelchair. He's a chair user. And he gets really frustrated because that chair separates him from the activities in PE and the incident that caused her to call. They'd gone to OSU and they'd been in the auditorium, and the chair, the ramp was too big, and he was afraid it was going to tilt over. So he ended up sitting at the top of the theater while the entire class was down in the front row, and it was very upsetting to him. And so she went and she talked to the school, and part of what we talked about was, well, why didn't he go and talk to the school? Because then it's less conflict oriented too. I'm angry that this happened to my child, for him to say, I felt this way when I was all alone at the back of the room, and it gives him the chance to know who to talk to and where to raise. So I think I don't think we think about that very often early on, to give students those skills to say when something isn't working. Or
and being a parent, I'm a newer parent now, but you want to throw like the protective arm out and just do that and all, and to try and have somebody coach you through that, like, how do I let you, I dub it supported failure. That's crazy concept for some people, to be like, we're going to fail, but we're going to support them through it so we can talk through what didn't go well and what you could do in the future. But supported failure means a bad GPA, which means you're not going to go somewhere. Like, whatever it links to, we always just say, like, forget the negatives, and strengths are always great, but being real about our deficits is a whole other, it's a hard conversation to have.
Yeah, there's your hand going up, Bridget.
I think you brought out another point that I think is going to be important for the task force to grapple with, that I think we've been grappling with for years, and it's the expectation of high school and college settings being different, expectations being different, laws being different. And so the issue around accommodations and being fluent in the use of accommodations and not using modifications, I think a lot of teachers buy that and believe in it. But we also have an obligation that we have to give a free, appropriate public education, which includes modifications. And that transition isn't built into either of those laws to allow us to transition legally. And so I think we're going to hit, that's where we get some conflicts and hits. Again, if we start earlier, we might be able to move kids from modifications to accommodations. But I think that's another one that I think should be transparently addressed so that people feel comfortable at the K-12 system starting to work more towards this and letting go of modifications when there's some question of the legality of it.
I think one of the other big pieces, you know, part of what you bring up around transitions, there's this balance of a lot of what kids with disabilities experience transitioning to college is what all kids experience. And helping both the kids and the parents understand that. That not calling home is pretty typical for all students when they first go to college. You know, the perhaps not doing as well as you thought you would the first term is pretty typical for a lot of students having nothing to do with disability. So there's also this balance act of sort of supportive failure or supportive bumps in the road, which have nothing to do with disability. And I think the other piece that certainly for me I've seen becoming more challenging over the years is
we're seeing a broader array of more complex disabilities and how that plays out outside the classroom. So residence halls, getting involved in activities on class. So typically for students and parents, you know, you go and you visit college, and really the first thing people look at is, do they have the academic program I want or something? And then, as Melissa said, you go with your gut. And then it really is, a lot of the things I deal with are not classroom accommodations. It's things that are coming up in the residence hall. It's things that are coming up in being able to, you know, I've got my accommodation in the classroom, but no one will talk to me, and I don't know how to get connected with groups, or whatever it is. And again, for us in higher ed, it's a very different role in terms of how we intercede or not in that, or how we help students get connected, and it's an awkward role for parents too. They're trying to find their boundaries in that. You can't go on a college campus and say, play with my son. It doesn't work. You know, so that's another whole realm that is sort of unfolding right now, that I think when people talk about accommodations and documentation, you're thinking about the academic piece, and really college, particularly if you're going to live there, you know, commuting to a community college is a little bit different, but if you're going to live there, it's not just about the classes you're going to. In K-12, you're in school from, you know, 7:30 to 3. In college, maybe you're in class for 2 hours a day. What do you do with the rest of your time? What's happening? And that's, again, sort of that discussion with students beyond that piece of, you know, what are my strengths, what are my potential areas I need more support, but also just thinking about, how do I want to be as a person in this new place? It's a very different way to have a discussion. We don't sit down with other students and begin the conversation with what's not working for you. And we set students with disabilities up for that every single time. Who always wants to talk about what's not working? That's a horrible place. No wonder students don't want to disclose, if every conversation they have is, so tell me what's not working. So you're right, that dynamic has to change from way back, and, you know, we're balancing that because we need to know what's not working to get the accommodations, but that's also not what we want to focus on with students.
Clint DeLong, Voc Rehab Counselor. One of the things that I do regularly with my clients, whether they're students or adults or whatever, is to talk to them about their disabilities so they can understand their disabilities and how they affect them in lots of different areas of their life. And also explore ways to level the playing field, assistive technology, those sort of things. So I'd really encourage y'all to use us as a resource, because even if the student comes to us and doesn't ultimately become eligible for our program, we have a 60-day window from when they apply to talk to them, counsel them, explore these different areas of their lives, and you know, maybe we can kind of set them on a path, even if they don't end up being eligible for our program.
So. All of you mentioned documentation. What ideally would a student have before they leave the high school and they come to your campus? What should they make sure they do before they walk out of that high school for the last time?
I can, so I can speak to that. And it, we all kind of deal with, we all have different ways of setting this up on each campus as the conversation has been moving along, you know that. At the community college level, I tell students, hey, you know, I can work with you because you have your IEP. There's not a lot of information there, but I know you had the IEP, okay? And you can tell me that your medication makes you drowsy in the afternoon, and you can tell me that you have a hard time focusing when there's distraction. You know, I can piece this together. But it would be, if you're planning on transferring to university, you're going to want to have that information. And I have the conversation with them, and I say, the reason is not for the disability services office
at the university so much as it is for you. I want you to understand your disability, just like I was saying before, and an assessment will help you understand your disability. So particularly on our campus, we have over 60% of our students with disabilities have hidden disabilities, and that is usually a learning disability of some sort. And if they don't know what their learning disability is, not only are they going to have a challenge at the university, they're going to have a challenge when they enter the workforce of being able to work with their disability. I brought general, just very, 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 very general and basic guidelines for documentation. And then I have more, I didn't bring them with me, but I have more specific guidelines for psychological disabilities, health, chronic. But again, these are very loose guidelines. If I have someone who can come to me and speak to their disability, if a student comes that's a wheelchair user, I'm not going to say, can you please go to your doctor and have them write a letter that says that you're a wheelchair user? I mean, you know, we obviously don't do that. You know that. So I have some very, very, very basic guidelines for documentation. I can forward along the others. They're pretty detailed. I'd like to maybe change them so that they're more user-friendly for our students, but it's what I'm working with now. So.
Is that something that could be in terms of the assessments? I mean, every student has to do a 3-year reassessment for their eligibility for special ed. And would there be a way, and I think this is more towards the high school people, that that could be worked into that 3-year reeval that's going to happen at some point during high school where the appropriate assessments are there and done, so they're not having to go out and go through that whole process again of being assessed and it's available?
You take this one. I want to hear the answer. I'm excited.
This is Danielle Sheldrake, Administrator for Student Services for the Beaverton School District. So as some may be aware of, through kind of the guidelines with 3-year reevaluation, we're not required to do a full-blown assessment every year or every 3 years. The IEP team comes together and determines what kind of evaluations need to happen in order to continue their special ed eligibility. A lot of times we have kids that there hasn't been a change in their cognitive, you know, performance, in their adaptive skills, or even maybe their academic skills. And so the team might say, we're just going to do a file review for the student, but there's no firm, you have to do a test. From a district perspective, I get the value, long-term value for the student. It's a lot of work for a staff member to do an evaluation that isn't going to drive educational planning in the K-12 system. So you're not going to get a lot of school districts who are going to say, sure, I'm going to evaluate a student their 12th grade year. They're not staying with us. They're graduating at the end of this year. We don't need this information for educational planning. So it comes down to resources. And oftentimes, families will come and ask, oh, I need a new cognitive assessment for them to go to OSU. And the district's going to say, well, we don't need that to reestablish your eligibility, and we don't need it for educational planning. So why would we do it and usually won't?
Can I ask a clarifying question on that? How is it not captured in the transition plan expectation?
Because doing a new evaluation, a whole new cognitive assessment, is not required for a transition plan. We do a transition assessment, which usually talks about what kind of wants and needs for the student. We have like a 4-pronged approach around living and education and leisure and rec. I can't think of the... I'm looking at more. I'm trying to think of the other one. But we look at those pieces, but that doesn't mean that we have to do a cognitive assessment for a student. We do different functional transition types of assessments where we use maybe if it's a student who's in receiving resource room services at the high school level, usually we use the CIS, it's the College Information Systems program that comes out of the U of O, where they're looking at all of those pieces. But a cognitive assessment at that point isn't what the focus of the educational planning is. It's how am I going to function in life, like with peers, leisure and rec, academically, not the IQ piece. And so that becomes a hang up, you know, because then families are trying to figure out how to get an assessment. And from a district perspective, it's not driving our educational planning for that student at that point. And in some cases, we've had kids who have been in special education since early childhood or, you know, early elementary, and we might have a couple of assessments in the file. So when they get to high school, it's like, why would we pull a kid out of class, spend multiple hours to assess them when we already have the information that we need to continue to their education plan?
So I would say this is the gap that's occurring. And so what happened, and it makes sense, right? I mean, that's the piece, like, okay, makes sense for your purpose. I think what's difficult is, so I don't know what happens in third and fifth grade, but it seems to be when assessments stop. So they do either RTIs or they're then, or response to intervention, or they're getting together and going, yep, we're still good, still has a learning disability. And so when they become 18 and they're in the college environment, we don't feel that the disability went away, but the impacts and strategies in the academic environment have changed. And without a current assessment, it's hard to get a good capture of what that impact is in the educational environment. So then the students are kind of lost at this point. And especially at Western, when really we serve low income, first gen, and documented disabilities, that is kind of our niche. And what's hard is that you've got low income and documented disabilities or first gen, and I'm saying, you know what would be a good investment? $1,000 assessment.
Yeah.
Yeah. Guess what the response is? It's not real positive. And they don't get the trajectory of the benefit. And even when I talk about possibly it's a one-time disability-related expense due to financial aid, maybe this, maybe that, when those kinds of things are like, yeah, that's still like, And so I can kind of, by the kind of the skin of my teeth, work with them and serve them, but can I give them everything they need based on an 18-year-old impact due to a cognitive-related learning disability? Maybe not. And I think that's where this significant gap is occurring.
And I just wonder if it seems clear that that's a gap, if this might be a place for a recommendation. If we look at where education policy is going in the state with 40-40-20 and wanting to take underserved populations to move into post-secondary education and have them transfer through this, this might be a good focus for one of the OEIB grants, is what is the process for accessing and paying for the assessment. So that's, would people be comfortable with, we can follow up with Nancy and maybe look at including something like that in our recommendations.
And there have been, over the years, at different points in time, again, depending on the financial place of things, different ways schools, K-12 and colleges, have worked together in very creative, out-of-the-box ways to do that. So, for example, in Lane County for a while, they would have a day that schools could identify kids that were heading up to the universities. Everybody would donate a school psych, and they would do the adult version, because it needs the adult version, of the assessments, which we usually don't give. And the ESD would host the space, and they would bus kids over, and teachers would have done some stuff ahead of time, and they would only have to be there a short period of time. And it was a lot of logistical stuff, but it worked for a while, and then people started pulling their monies back. Or Clackamas for a while taught a class where the person who taught the class was licensed to do assessments, and it was about learning about your disability, and you completed the assessments if you wanted to as part of the class. So there are ways to get at it. It's about getting the two systems to kind of work.
And then Bob.
I have to agree wholeheartedly with what you said, and I come up against this with transition students all the time, is they come in with IEP records, and often there's not any sort of an evaluation in the IEP records that I get that is by a licensed treatment provider, which is what we need. But also, if there is, it's usually from when they were 9 and like 11, and we need records that are current within 2 years, and you got the dollar amount right, a good LD eval is about $1,000. And so, yeah, there's definitely a gap.
I just had a question about assessments, because like I was looking at your piece of paper, and it seemed to talk about having a diagnostic statement of the nature and extent of the disability. Then there was another statement made earlier about how just a label or just a diagnosis isn't going to get us where we want to get. So when we're talking about assessment, I'm wondering, what exactly are we talking about? And again, it makes complete sense to me that an assessment then when the kid is 3 isn't going to inform you well about what accommodations or supports a kid is going to need in the college setting. So what does this ideal assessment look like?
Can I speak to that? This is wonderful. I'm really amped up about this conversation. I hope you are as excited as I am. It's really good to have these conversations. So I'm very glad to be here. and I apologize for jumping the gun on this, but I have a lot of thoughts rolling around in my head. One is that speaking to this issue, we're in the same boat. We put together a list of people in the area that do learning disabilities assessments. I have 9 copies. I don't think it'd be very useful for you, but I'll leave them here so you have them. And it's a living document. We're constantly adding to it. If anybody contacts us and tells us that they're doing assessments, we add them to the list. But it ranges from, you know, $500 to $1,500 for the assessment. We do have a couple of places that will do it for free on a sliding fee scale. George Fox University will do it. Their students will do assessments, and the student has to bring a low-income voucher to the appointment. The wait list is a mile long, you know, but we give these options, you know, if you have insurance. So that's one piece that I wanted to speak to. Your question is a good one, and I think the reason that we want the assessment, part of the reason I want the assessment is, regardless of accommodation or environment, a student is going to change from the time they're in high school to college developmentally, even if they don't have a disability. I'm a much different person than I was when I was 18, than I am now, you know, than I was when I was 18. So their disability shifts and changes too. We learn how to accommodate ourselves. I came here and I moved one seat over so I could see the person that I needed to listen to, because I know I wouldn't be able to hear her unless I could read her lips. Things like that need to be assessed. And once they are, getting to the meat of your question, not only do we have the diagnosis, but a good assessment will give us recommendations for the classroom experience. And that is something that, if we have that, we can have the conversation with the student and say, it says here that audiobooks are recommended. How do you feel about that? Sometimes they'll say, no, I know I don't learn very well that way. I don't want to try that. And sometimes they'll say, I would love that. I didn't even know I could access that. And then it will give us just more information that we can use to talk with a student, develop a relationship, help them understand their disability, and go into the world and be empowered with that information. So for me, it's not so much about the label. It's not the diagnosis on that piece of paper. It's the whole assessment and a give and take with the student and helping them understand it and use that information in an empowering way.
A really good example for me are, for instance, students with cerebral palsy. So at one point, I had, I think, 4 or 5 students at a different institution I was working at. And one student was receiving certain accommodations, and another student came in and said, I have cerebral palsy too. How come I'm not getting that accommodation? So if you just go with the diagnosis, cerebral palsy, it's like, okay, that's good. But what does that really tell me? And so that's where you get at what's the impact, because the impact then tells you, does it rise to the level of disability and what might the student need in a particular environment. So that's what I mean when I say diagnosis is not disability. And students with ADHD, LD do the same thing. Well, I have ADHD. You know what that means. Well, we know in general how that impacts students, but it's still very individualized. And that, from the legal side for us, you know, the K-12 laws versus higher ed, one of the things is we have to do a case-by-case assessment. What does this person sitting in front of me right now need? Not what does the label of ADHD need? What does the label of LD need? What does this student need? How is it impacting them? And so that's where the ideal documentation is, what's the diagnosis, but how does it impact this person? What are the barriers to them in a higher ed environment? I mean, that's the ideal. So that's where the suggestions come in. And sometimes even if the person, whether it's doctor, psychologist, psychiatrist, you know, depending on what the disability is, if they can even give us impact, we're pretty good at then going, oh, here's what we think might work in this environment. That's what our job is. That's what we're really good at. Mm-hmm. But we need to know the impact. And sometimes even that discussion with the student, so we can tease it out even further.
and have those conversations. But when we just, when I just get that, you know, 3-page letter, whether it's from the high school or the doctor, the psychiatrist, that says, John has fill in the blank, please give him all the accommodations he needs. It's like, thanks, not helpful. So does that sort of answer your question a little bit?
Oh, yeah. That's very helpful.
I will say, too, that although we do fall under the same law, and I think we're fairly similar in some of our approaches, the interpretation of the ADA, even with the Amendment Act, so there are people who are going towards more of the engagement interaction, starting with the student interview. There's some that are still fairly heavy on the documentation. There's some that sit fairly in the middle. And so, again, in the transition plan for both students and parents, because we're going to create the parent one, I would love for them to understand that when they're shopping colleges, that although we won't say, okay, this is your diagnosis, this is what you'll get, but we could talk about and have that interactive discussion about, well, in general, it kind of looks like this, or this is what we would maybe need, those kinds of things, because there is still that room for interpretation and the applicability component of the law. So keeping that in mind, which, again, you know, adds some gap, because that means that somebody has that ability to navigate some of those discussions. And the documentation piece varies. Of course, if we're talking about mental health, are we talking about learning disability, a combination of the two.
Can I ask a follow-up?
So I've got Brian and Clint and then Bob, and after that we have to wrap up this agenda item and move on to the next one. We've fallen a little behind. So Brian?
I think a recommendation is really good. I think being aware about how that pushes on the federal IDEA is really important, because when we look at, like, at the primary K through 12, when we're doing eligibilities, we're following different criterias. And that's the big push when we talk about documentation. Documentation and eligibilities are different. And the big conversation here is learning disability, which has a specific criteria and has also changed over the past few years with the different implementations, like with RTI and stuff. Whereas if you go to other eligibilities, criteria is different that doesn't drive certain assessments. And therefore, that assessment's left off because, hey, they had a doctor say they had autism when they were in third grade. You still got it. Like, that's not something, you know, so that you're not going to get the documentation that others want, because the criteria that the public school, the K through 12, has to do, they got their ducks in a row and they're following it. So a recommendation is really good, but, and this is where I kind of get a little bit, like, I know special ed law, but I don't know no special ed law, and that's where we're pushing up against, is that federal mandate of IDEA. So it should be kind of like dovetailed, so we don't make a recommendation that steps out of the kind of realm of the federal law there.
Although it might be, if the recommendation is that it's not necessarily a special ed thing, but we're looking at it more from the frame of, in Oregon, we're trying to encourage more kids to pursue post-secondary. So maybe it would be outside of that 3-year reevaluation, but you're looking on a transition plan and seeing this student's goal is to go on to a 2-year or 4-year institution, and therefore feed them into this process of how do we collect all of the information and materials that we need for the student to be able to be accepted and be able to be successful once they get there. Does that make
sense?
When
it's going down like that, yeah, that's a good point.
Clint.
Yes, so I'd just like to give an example of a good eval versus a bad eval. I had a young man come into our office, apply for services. He has a traumatic brain injury. He fell off an ATV when he was like 13, smacked his head on the cement. And he had an evaluation done that was soon after that occurrence that said that he had dementia. And so he'd been carrying around this diagnosis of traumatic brain-induced dementia for like 6 years. And when I met with him, it's like, this kid doesn't have dementia. So I had another evaluation done by Robert Weniger. He's the most amazing evaluator. We use him all the time. And it turns out the kid has an IQ over 100. He's got all kinds of strengths that will suit him well in college. So this was a big awakening for him, because he wasn't even sure he wanted to try college because of this evaluation that had been done. And so when I told him this, he's like, wow, this is just makes me feel like I'm not broken anymore. So, you know, that's just a real good example of a good eval versus a bad eval.
Bob?
We were just over here chatting about the fact that, you know, one of the lessons that I'm picking up here is that good assessments need to take into account an entire person's life, because we are talking about not only experience in the classroom, but experience in, for lack of a better term, becoming an adult and being self-supporting. That's something you're certainly not going to get in third and fifth grade from an assessment. And so the question that comes to my mind is how one can effectively access that type of an assessment so that, and without that, it would be difficult for a person to succeed, it seems to me. It's hard enough succeeding as a kid in college without disabilities these days. So just an observation.
Any final thoughts from the panel or the group before we close out this agenda item?
I think my last one would just be that this really is a tool that can help. And assessment's just one component of it. Again, I want to look at this from so many other directions about, I would love to have empowerment camps and classes and that parent piece. But I think the biggest thing is that the difference between the tools, so you start to realize that it also connects with other federal laws. So if a student doesn't have what they need to be successful and therefore receive accommodations in higher education, and then they fail the first term, then they come to us, we finally get them in line for an assessment, and it takes the second term, they've now lost their eligibility for financial aid. So regardless of how many accommodations we can magically give them all of a sudden with the magic wand, at that point they then have to opt out. And that, because the federal financial aid laws have changed, that's also impacting them. So again, we got to be on the front side of this. So when students come in, whether they choose to or not, that's the great thing about higher education. They can choose to come and register and be part of disability services if they choose to do so. But if they choose to do so, they should have the tools that they need to access them. Regardless of who pays for it, how it happens, I don't know. That's that's what I would love to see happen.
I'd like to see an emphasis on education about the individual's brain at an early age. I would like to see that starting in grade school, because so many times they have no idea what their disability is. They know that there's something wrong with them. They have no idea what it is, no words to talk about how it feels to them, what they might need. And I just think that's a travesty. So often there's relief under when they find out, oh, it's ADHD or whatever it is. Oh, that makes sense to me. That's why my brain works the way it does. And then there's so much neuroscience research these days about how to work more effectively with the brains that we all have. So, you know, and there's great, you know, there are great programs to teach that kind of information to better strategize, to tolerate distress, to deal with failure and use that as a springboard for more solutions. So, yeah, I'd like to see education start very early.
Mm-hmm. Bridget, did you have something you wanted to toss in?
Quick one. I realize I haven't introduced myself and not everybody over here knows. Bridget Flannery, University of Oregon, special education and the University Center on Excellence and Disability. But I think that the other thing we need to remember in the recommendations is, from a pre-service and in-service perspective, our teachers do not get enough information around preparing kids for post-secondary education. We are really heavy on the K-3, K-5 reading and literacy, and that's really important if they're going to be successful. But all the issues that have come up today, we get basically in the pre-service, you know, might have a night or two, and in the in-service, it doesn't necessarily when it gets expanded. So I think it's an area that we'll probably have to have training. You asked in the beginning about training. I think it's clearly a training area, and parents from the parent centers.
Well, thank you all.
Thank you for the time. It's wonderful to hear that there's a task force here working on these issues that we're all passionate about. And I brought business cards. I would like to just forward some of these materials digitally just to save paper, if that's okay. I assume
absolutely.
Victoria would be my contact for that.
Yeah.
But thank you. I'll leave some business cards. Thank you so much. I think I can speak for all of us when I say we're glad that this work is happening. We appreciate you taking the time to talk about it.
Well, and thank you for taking the time during a busy time of year to come up and talk with us. It's been really helpful. And the good news about those materials, when you get them to Victoria, they can all go into OLIS, right?
Sure.
Which means that we can all easily share those materials with other folks.
Great.
Fabulous.
Great.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you so much.
So Bridget last comment actually flowed quite nicely into the next agenda item, which is, how well are students being encouraged to pursue post-secondary opportunities? And we have Chris.
I'm Chris Benesky, and I actually live in Pendleton, Oregon. And a lot of maybe what I'm going to share, I was asked to speak on four specific questions, one being how well students are being encouraged, also how are they being included college fairs, how are they introduced to college credit earning opportunities, and how is college discussed with students earning modified diplomas. A lot of the things that, I live in Pendleton, obviously in a rural issue, definitely on the far side of the state. Pretty isolated in a lot of ways, especially with our students that we serve. I did, however, grow up in suburban, west side of the community, so I'm familiar with both areas. But definitely, in talking with colleagues and whatnot, throughout Eastern Oregon, we have, kind of get-togethers among, different counselors. And by the way, I'm a school counselor. among my colleagues, as far as talking about, encouraging students to pursue post-secondary education, we always run up against, and it's not unique to any one specific population, whether it's students with disabilities or just our general population of students. But we serve low-income, first generation. A lot of times, students who live very isolated. I work with students every single day who have never been out of Umatilla County. Their world is very small. Now in Pendleton, we're fortunate enough to have Blue Mountain Community College right there, and Eastern Oregon in La Grande, and I'm going to talk a little bit about Eastern Oregon here in a minute, and kind of a relationship that we have going with them. I think one of the things that particularly with students with disabilities, it's very intimidating. I mean, we can go right off of what was said earlier. It's very intimidating when you talk about students or talk with students about pursuing college who are barely making it in high school. And the whole idea of this is so much bigger and so much harder and so much more difficult. And the real world, and I hate that term, but... one of the things I always do is not necessarily talk about college initially with kids. I talk about post-secondary training, and that comes in many forms. And it can be college, and it can be a vocational program inside of a college, or, not traditional, just write 10-page papers all the time and those types of things. And it opens the door to it not being so overwhelming. And I think that's one place to really start, as far as encouraging kids who have had very little successes a lot of times in school from very young on. And I think that's really our language that we use, I think, is very, very important when we talk to students. Anyway, as far as like college fairs and things like that, we have kind of regional college fairs. And one of the things that we do to try to attract, kids from all over varying smaller communities around, we have as many, colleges and stuff that we can get. We actually host one in Pendleton High School. And we offer, just a general scholarship. You put your name in a hat and we'll pull a scholarship out, $500 scholarship, open to anybody. And those types of things attract not just your higher... your higher achieving students, but the thought that anybody can get a scholarship, essentially, if they show up, visit, a certain amount of tables and talk to people and get business cards and they put their name in a hat, and it works pretty well. And we really drive those types of things. And as far as being introduced to college credit earning opportunities, we've very recently established relationship with Eastern Oregon through the Eastern Promise. And the Eastern Promise is quite a big program, but And it starts elementary all the way through. But as far as just specific college earning opportunities, what the Eastern Promise has really allowed us to do is to offer some college credit opportunity earnings or earning opportunities in classes that you wouldn't normally peg as college credit opportunity classes. For example, my wife's a health teacher. She teaches a junior level health class that, you know, given the opportunity to do, you know, some extra stuff in the class, kids can earn, you know, college credit through the Eastern Promise. We offer college credit through a class called Success 101. That it's a district requirement for graduation for freshmen that they can earn, wind up earning college credit through, given, you know, they jump through the specific hoops. Well, when you start opening things like that up to more general, you know, classes that are not necessarily limited to your higher achieving students, it starts exposing, you know, the students with disabilities or, you know, just general population students an opportunity to kind of see that they can be successful and sort of chip away at the whole idea that college is unattainable for them. You know, and I would absolutely echo, as far as kind of referring back to encouraging students to pursue post-secondary education, I think one of the things that we lack, particularly in Eastern Oregon, is relationships with our disability services among colleges not BMCC and Eastern Oregon. We have a very good relationship with Wade Mueller, you know, at BMCC, who's in charge of disability services there and whatnot, and we, you know, do lots of things with him and whatnot, but we really don't have established relationships with you know, I-5 corridor schools, essentially. And I would like to see, you know, for us out there, maybe a broader opportunity to have exposure and things like that. You know, like I said, our students, a lot of them are very low income, first generation. The idea of just leaving Umatilla County to go anywhere on vacation is often, you know, overwhelming, let alone a college visit. You know, our students are not exposed. They're isolated out there. Even a lot of our higher performing students are, you know, our non-disabled, you know, 4.0s, kids going to Stanford, you know, are very isolated kids. And so having more opportunities for our students in kind of these rural areas to be able to, you know, see what it's like outside of their daily life, you know, and I know that can be, you know, in many ways similar to what happens in more suburban areas also, but you know, that is certainly a challenge that we face all the time. When we talk about kids, we just approach, you know, the idea of going to Clackamas Community College or something like that, and they've never been, you know, east of or west of Hood River. You know, they have no idea what that looks like. As far as obviously college being discussed with students earning modified diplomas, the financial aid piece is changing, you know, and that sort of thing just very recently. But I think, as with anything, like Brian was saying, that has to start. It's not something that needs to start at the 11th grade or the freshman year. And I think one of the things that the Eastern Promise is doing, our relationship with, through kind of facilitated through the Intermountain Educational Services District, is it's allowing some of our lower grades to have initial exposure to you know, tours at Eastern and all kinds of different things. My son is a fifth grader who has autism and you know, faces a lot of the social challenges, you know, and whatnot, but, you know, 2 weeks ago he went with his class to Eastern Oregon University and got, you know, a great tour. He took his camera, took all kinds of pictures, came home really excited, you know. And prior to that, he only got excited about Legos, you know. And, you know, so that was really, you know, really neat to see, you know, those kinds of things happening. But I think establishing
better relationships with our disability services again, and all the things that were talked about, you know, just previously, are really important things to help.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for Chris or things to add in?
I'm stationed. I live in rural Yadkin County, and transportation is the biggest issue amongst most of my transition students. Even those who are willing to consider maybe going to Temecula, which now has a campus in McMinnville, that it doesn't offer all the classes needed for the degrees that are available. And so when they have to stop and think, well, maybe I'll have to actually go to the Salem campus, it's like a huge red flag for them. First off, how could they actually get there, because many of them don't drive? So I mean, part of the VR Folk Rehab Youth Transition Program is that the youth transition specialist will arrange tours of college campuses and will actually take groups of students to the colleges or to the job corps sites. But that doesn't take care of that one factor of how are they going to get there if they decide to go there. So it's a big issue.
Can I jump
on?
In this concept of recommendations or report that we do, and piggybacking on like the modified diploma piece. So I case manage high schoolers. So I'll get IEPs from a freshman, and their eighth grade says that it might have modified curriculum or modified coursework or something along those lines. But then when I sit down with the parents, I sit down with the student, and we talk about, so sometime in middle school, did you guys talk about high school diploma types? Did you talk about high school diploma options? Did you talk about what, if you're on a trajectory in middle school that they're modifying something for you, do you know what that means at the high school level? And what's the like pros and cons? And Sally, when she's been here with like the booklet and stuff and the trickle down, I kind of am, you know, I see a bigger perspective being here and different things I do, but then I also go back to like my classroom and my building and my district and those kind of things. And so I don't know what's out there from a state perspective and I don't really like the word mandate, because you never know if that actually is followed. So maybe it is something like a suggestion, a recommendation, a something on how do you have those conversations? And Bridget talks a lot of like how do we educate, or how do we make any kind of recommendations that somebody teaching at the 6th, 7th, and 8th grade year feels comfortable and confident to talk about what high school would look like with diploma types. So parents are being educated prior to showing up at high school and being like, wait, what do you mean? Because we were getting these accommodations at middle school where it didn't really matter. You know, we age up, so we move up or something like that. High school kind of hits them with a pretty big load there, and they don't realize like they're on this trajectory to modify diplomas. And I think that piece the piece of the equity with the financial aid is really nice. There's also a piece that the stigma comes up. I'm on a modified diploma, and I don't want that. My son or daughter is not like that person, and we really struggle. And professionally, I'm going through a handful of these conversations right now. Like, I'm not sure you're going to be able to graduate high school on the trajectory you're on because you need more supports. But I'm having that conversation what seems like for the first time in 10th grade year. And we did talk about at one point in here that, you know, at middle school they sign a piece of paper at the IEP meeting that says we talked about diploma types. What does that conversation look like? Is that just like, here's a piece of paper, there's three different diplomas at high school, cool, you're aware about them, see you later. And I don't know if we can do a recommendation or something that starts these conversations and has these real, like, it's built into IDEA, you know, you're supposed to be doing these progress monitorings, you're supposed to be reporting on progress and where somebody's really at. But to see the bigger picture and the trajectory on where that moves to and what implications that can have on the long term, it becomes a more serious conversation when the parents and the student realize I might not graduate high school. Why didn't anybody tell me in sixth grade I was reading at this grade level and the rest of my class was at this grade level? And maybe it's in there, maybe it's sometimes happening or not always happening, but it's been my experience, it's not happening enough, if it is happening.
So really starting those conversations a lot earlier with an eye towards what's the ultimate goal that this
If you're graduating high school on a regular diploma or a modified diploma, but you have found the course of easiest resistance through high school, so you're still academically behind. The jump to freshman year is still, I mean, that's why there's at a community college placement tests. And you're testing into Math 10, but you somehow got through Algebra 2. There's a discrepancy there that you got to start scratching your head and wonder what's going on.
Mike.
Mike Mealy, Department of Human Services. What's interesting to me in listening to the discussion today, you know, building on what you were just saying and what the panel was saying, and just what, from my particular vantage point, is certainly individuals with more significant, you know, disabilities, is the themes that have emerged in our conversations around how do we get to a successful transition. You know, and one is the starting early and the expectations. You know, so you overcome low expectations and start getting a preferred vision that people, parents and students and everybody's emerging together. I think a second one, and I think, Chris, what you're talking about is we've got to figure out a way to get those real-world experiences, you know, into the lives of students, and whether they are work opportunities or other kinds of things. That's another theme that you hear. I thought we were hearing from the panel, at least in terms of my ear, and Bob, I think, was articulating this earlier, was that we've got to, at some point, go from evaluations and assessment to something a little more personal than that. You know, and in the world of people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, you're starting to hear this term discovery. Is what is it that makes that person at their best and unique to them? And it's something beyond an assessment. It's really learning about them as a person and how they make supports work for them and what their needs and talents are. And the other significant thing is bridging from looking at just the environment that they're in to that 360 scope. Because what may be manifesting as, you know, an issue may be resolved somewhere else in that person's life, or the knowledge about that. So how do we look, you know, at that person just outside of a classroom or outside of a school environment to kind of that 360? And that's the transition I think that Bob was talking about. When you go to college, now you have to think in 360 degrees, not just what's happening, you know, during an academic period. It's just interesting to me that there are themes that are emerging in the whole spectrum of transition, and those may be some areas where when we start talking about recommendations, what does that really mean? And then you add the teacher training, you know, around that, you know, the preparation and then the ongoing training. There's it's just interesting to me that it manifests that way.
Danielle?
There's just a couple things that I was thinking about. So in the diploma law, we notify students on IEPs starting at fifth grade of diploma options. A lot of parents, that is so far beyond, you know, when you're meeting at fifth grade and you're having a conversation about diplomas, like, why are we talking about this? But we do start that process. The thing I think about in terms of recommendations, and I just want this task force to really think about it, is that I want to be cautious that any recommendations we come up with don't just land in the world of special ed. Because I'm thinking about things, you know, we've talked about, you know, preparing them for college, and I'm thinking my special educators are not trained on what college looks like. My counselors are better trained on that piece, and they should be, you know, working with higher ed on how to do that transfer or what that looks like. So I guess I'm just, whatever recommendations come, that those have a broader scope in terms of the K-12 and post-secondary aspect, because in my experience, when recommendations come out and they somehow relate to students with disabilities, they wind up in special ed, and we're not always the best people to move that, because I'm thinking, okay, well, if I'm now assessing for this, how are we going to, you know, carry the load of what we're already assessing? And then if we're supposed to be writing transition goals on this, how are we going to add this to a plate of a six-hour day? I mean, it's all those factors that I think we really have to think about. It's like who, not just the here's the recommendation, but really who's responsible for those pieces. because I just know my colleagues, if we're rolling it out, are going to be a little, you know, overwhelmed. And how do you have Gen Ed, and you know, it's great we have Matt here at the table to talk about it, because it's bigger than, it's a big K-12 issue. It's actually pre-K.
Bridget?
I think two comments. One, Danielle, I totally believe it's bigger than special ed. I believe it's bigger than counselors. It's actually middle, high school, elementary issue because as the panel alluded to, there are students who don't have disabilities that are going to be on that cusp of not being successful in post-secondary. And they are going to be the ones they're talking about in the paper that have failed on their financial aid loans and everything else we're reading about. So I don't think it's just a disability. I totally agree. And so with the 20-40-40, we need to be hitting more kids. The second one is related to how well students are being encouraged. And I guess I'd just like to push forward an agenda you know I also have, which is around the movement nationally for post-secondary for students with intellectual and developmental disabilities. And that is not on the table in any school or classroom, or I would say maybe teeny young a few. We are not encouraging, and for a good reason, because we haven't done the work that is going to need to happen to figure out what that looks like in our Oregon colleges, community colleges and universities. And we that needs to get on the table because, you know, it's moving nationally and we are not moving as fast as the rest of the group. And it will come to us, and I'd prefer to get ahead of it and do it the way we want to do it than have it forced on us through legislation.
Well, thank you very much for this conversation. As always, we have a lot to talk about and not a lot of time. So let's quickly move on to our second pieces. We've got some folks here from ODE to give an update on the communication plan for making sure that students know and that all of the people that they encounter know that their modified diplomas count as diplomas and that they are eligible for federal financial aid. The reason that I put this on the agenda, kids are still being denied. I mean, I got a call from a student that went into Rogue Community College yesterday and was told that they weren't eligible and that the state had not provided clear communication. So I forwarded to them both your memo and Ben Cannon's memo, who I believe wrote directly to all of the financial aid administrators and said it is the policy of the state of Oregon. But can you talk a little bit about where we are and what we can do to make sure kids aren't just giving up and walking away?
Sure. Chair Gelser, members of the task force, I'm Jan McComb, the legislative director for the Department of Education. And to my, I'll start with my left, is Laura Petschauer. She is the lead for the Systems Performance Review and Improvement Program, which is a mouthful, but basically what she does is monitor districts as to how well they work with students with disabilities, and she works with a lot of data. And to my right is Melissa Glover. She's an ed specialist for secondary transitions. So essentially, as Representative Gelser knows very well, our assistant superintendent, Sarah Drinkwater, has had multiple discussions with the U.S. Department of Education. And on April 21st, we sent out a numbered memo, that's an official communication from the department, to all the superintendents. And that same day, Ben Cannon, who is the administrator for the Higher Ed Coordinating Commission, forwarded that memo to all the financial directors in Oregon colleges. So, you know, concerns have been raised, particularly by the community colleges, and Ben Cannon sent out a second memo repeating the information that all the diplomas were eligible for financial aid, trying to clarify that, and kind of sternly requesting that if people were saying something different, to call him and explain why they were saying something different, so he could get a handle as to what their concerns were. We also continue to field some phone calls from the districts. Laura, you want to talk about the call you got the other day?
Yes. So since the memo, we've taken lots of calls from community colleges, ESD, special ed directors all over the state. And from that, we've been able to provide some, you know, Q&A kind of responses and take care of that. But this week earlier, I got a student calling me, 19-year-old girl who's in a community college, and she said that her school, her high school case manager called her and told her about this change. So she was calling us to say, is it really true? And so I spoke with her for a good 20 to 30 minutes, and she was so excited. I'm going to use the word Melissa used, stoked. She was so stoked about her opportunity. She's already in community college. She's taking courses part-time, but this is an opportunity for her to take more classes. She's working part-time and going to school part-time. So it was just wonderful to hear from her. The next day, she's like, I'm going to fill out the application. I said, you do that. And if you have any questions or you need any additional clarification or they're unsure about what your options are, I said, feel free to call me back and I will support you in that. So that was a very positive outcome that we're now hearing from, again, a student, 19-year-old girl. And I know Melissa took a call or had some communication with someone recently, which was equal.
Yeah, I was in the classroom up until last June, so I was a high school secondary special ed teacher. So a lot of the students that I worked with are either still in the schools or graduated last year and are still dealing with this transition. So when I heard about it, I started calling all my former students and parents and just kind of spread the word a little bit. And I had one mom just start crying because they were working so hard on getting scholarships and tracking things down, and they were pinching pennies. And because her son really, he's graduating in like 2 weeks, and he wants to work with preschool age kids, and he really wanted to go to Lane Community College so that he could kind of get a 2-year degree and be ready to work in childcare. And they were fully prepared to find a way to send him, but it has been a stressful couple years for them. And so she was just so excited. So it was just one of those moments where it's just meaningful.
Have they been successful when they have filled out the application at the community colleges? Are they accepting them, or are they pushing back on their eligibility once they're getting to the financial aid director office?
So my student told me that she applied last year, she qualified last year, but because of the modified, she actually was not provided the money. So this year, she didn't know it was an option. She's going back, like I said. And so I won't know the outcome unless she calls me back and says, they denied me or said I can't do this, which I did. Again, I told her, if you get any different information, please call me and let me know so I can support her through it. So not quite sure how many students are being told it as of right now, unless they, you know, they're not calling us.
What recourse does a student have if they're being told that? So students have called me, I've called the financial aid directors, and the financial aid directors have said, no, we're not going to do this, and they point to one financial aid director at a particular institution and say that everybody's waiting until this person says it's okay. And I guess I don't understand what else is needed, and if there's the authority that rests in a financial aid office to say that an Oregon High School diploma that the OAIB and the superintendent and the legislature have said is a real diploma isn't. I mean, what is the recourse that the kids have, and does that authority really rest with the community colleges to say your diploma isn't real?
Well, I would say that if a student is being told that they can't apply by a financial aid officer, I would encourage them to call Ben Cannon, because, again, he's the one that did send out a very, as you said, stern message that if you are denying a student to apply for financial aid based on that modified, he wants a discussion around what is your rationale. So I would probably say the exact same thing, you know, what is your reason for not following the guidance and the rule that has been, you know, put forth? So that would just sort of be my initial thought.
Hi, I'm Kate Kinder, and I'm from Portland Community College, and I'm by no means a financial aid expert there, so I'm not speaking on that behalf. But I've been in several meetings with community colleges across the state, and I guess my understanding is that community colleges are getting conflicted guidance from Oregon Department of Education and the Federal Department of Education. And so the Federal Department will say, yes, the state can determine that the modified diploma counts, that that's it, but there's additional testing requirements, is what the feds are saying. And so they're kind of waiting to figure out how. So I think the guidance is different, and obviously then for community colleges, that's huge if we are suddenly out of compliance with our federal financial aid requirements. And so that's, I think, where the rub is, and I'm not sure if that's been clarified. I obviously am not in my role would not know that, but that's my understanding of where is there's consultation being done, and it's what the feds are saying and states saying is not the same.
And I think that's based on a 2009 memo that nobody can find. I mean, there's been a public record search for something that somebody wrote. Nobody has it.
Yeah.
And that was when the ability to benefit test existed. It doesn't anymore. And that's for an equivalent. I mean, what the written rule from the U.S. Department of Education says is that a diploma is determined by the state. And if you have a diploma that's determined by the state as a diploma, it's eligible for financial aid. We've contacted again the U.S. Department of Education. They've said somebody from Oregon isn't getting back to them, but there's nobody in the department or OEIB that is waiting to return calls. So we don't even know who it is that's out there making that communication. In the meantime, kids are being denied, and it's just if a kid with another diploma went in and someone said, your diploma isn't real, it doesn't matter that the governor, your U.S. senator, your OEIB, your State Board of Education, your superintendent of public instruction have all said that it is, it just seems like there must be some recourse that these students can take, because they're walking away, and it doesn't seem like it should be in the authority of a financial aid officer to shut the door to post-secondary opportunity for 1,500 kids.
So I did see the end of a thread of an email. So this is all very questionable, but it looks like CCWD is talking to somebody different at the U.S. Department of Education, and I was trying to go back to find out who she was talking to and maybe put that together and work on that. Try to figure out, and they were saying they indicated that they would provide guidance, whereas they told us they would not provide guidance. So that is the little ball of string we have to unwind and figure out what's going on.
I think the financial aid offices primarily work with the Office of Post-Secondary Education. And I have actually heard in conference calls the official that we are most likely to work with and who is most likely to make rulings or decisions like that say, in so many words, I haven't really been part of that conversation, and I'm not really sure whether that's okay or not. And, I have his name, so, I probably could communicate with him, but perhaps it needs to be someone at a higher level than mine that communicates with him. Perhaps Ben Cannon could communicate with him and find out whether, on a higher level, official to official level, we can get the post-secondary office to give us some kind of private letter or something.
And the post-secondary office was at the meeting. Their assistant secretary was at the meeting. So I don't think a lower level person has the ability to overturn the U.S. assistant secretary around. I don't understand. From the outside, it appears that the financial aid officers are going out of their way to deny this opportunity to kids. And where there are so many letters and clear policy, Ben has been really clear. Ben is the executive director of the HEC. Why? I mean, what is the problem with giving these kids the opportunity, and why are the financial aid officers appearing to try to undo some very difficult work and undermine the authority of the governor and Rob Saxton and Nancy Golden and Jeff Merkley?
Because I think they're getting conflicting guidance from other parts of the Department of Education, from the U.S. Department of Education.
But they should go through Ben Cannon, because the U.S. Department of Education doesn't know who they are talking to here. I called back and reaffirmed. Sarah Drinkwater has called back and reaffirmed. It's not an issue of whether or not this is an accepted equivalent to a high school diploma, which is what the question was in 2009 in the memo. The issue is this a high school diploma? The department says Rob Saxton and the governor get to decide what is a diploma, and they have decided that this is a diploma. And the Office of Post-Secondary Education doesn't have an opinion on that, because it's a state authority to decide what a diploma is.
Just the other day, so we were talking with PCC about this. So we have an early college relationship, and so our representative was working with them, and at that point they were notified, and this was just a couple days ago, no, students aren't eligible. However, on the 15th, we got notification that they are eligible. So someone finally informed the financial aid office at PCC that they're eligible. So I don't know if the mass communication hasn't been out to all the financial aid officers, but that was one of the things we ran up because with, but then we got an email and said they're good to go and they can go ahead and get financial aid.
Are they still finding some, we have Running Start in our district through LBCC, but the kids still need to meet the placement test requirements to get into the program. And we've found a little flexibility on the writing placement test, but none in reading and math. And so, you know, technically it works, but in reality, no. But I'm optimistic kids who want to go into a certification program, mm-hmm. that they should qualify for financial aid, but I haven't seen it play out yet, just a little too early in the process. But the it's still the same issue on some levels. If a kid especially just struggles in one area of the essential skills, and so, you know, no matter what that kid does, gets a modified here in 2 weeks, even if that kid chooses to come back next year because I want to meet that math benchmark, it's not probably going to happen. And I'm not sure that should disqualify that kid for taking regular ed courses at LB in any other area. I mean, the kid's going to avoid math like a plague. I get that. But there are other areas where the kid excels. So I don't, it's still going to be a little bit rough going, I think, as it plays out.
Well, and the placements, I think, are, I mean, the financial aid is one piece, the what you get into, and if you're qualified for the program, obviously that doesn't, this doesn't change. Bob, would you guys be willing to talk to some of these folks? I mean, is there legal action that they could take in terms of their diploma being denied on the basis of their disability?
Perhaps. Well, you know, I mean, the question is there a legal duty to act, and is one question, and if there is, then there is a legal right that attaches to that, so it would be worth talking about.
What about funding issues for the various colleges? I mean, aren't there, like, state funds that are provided to community colleges to support the operation?
Oh, so withholding
of
funds from community funds, colleges,
yeah,
if they're
that's,
not.
That's what I was getting to.
It's a really good idea.
Yes. I mean, money always seems to get people's attention, so.
Good idea. And then, so you are the right person for people to, for the students to call directly when they're having these experiences?
Yes, it's Sally and Melissa and myself kind of take all the calls related to this topic, so yes.
And do you guys have written anything written from the U.S. Department of Ed, or was that all verbal communication with parents?
I think we have seen anything in
writing. It's all been phone calls, conversations.
Yeah.
Bridget Planner, I think that the other thing might be somewhat tracking, I mean, that there's the stories out there, but tracking what community colleges or universities are the ones that are we're hearing about referring, and then whoever the point person is there. Because I think I worry about this becoming a every college and university mm-hmm. kind of media thing, as opposed to specific people down in the trenches that haven't gotten the information yet. So I think the other thing is, if people are calling in, is to ask what college or university they've applied to. Potentially, if they know the financial aid officer's name, to collect that, and then, you know, not necessarily collect the person calling's name, but getting back to those people and making sure they have the right information. Because we aren't good at communicating on a lot of things in the state, and so making sure the right people have the right piece of paper in their hand doesn't always happen.
Yeah, and I would agree, because I think, I mean, community colleges are really committed to access and want to do this. I have never heard anyone say, like, oh, you know, I think there's just wanting to make sure they're in compliance. And I think, you know, getting something in writing, you know, or just those pieces and the communication piece, because these are really large systems, especially when you're looking at large schools with multiple campuses. And so I don't, I mean, I think everyone wants to do it. It's just making sure, you know, there's a lot of regs around federal financial aid that if you aren't doing things correctly, there's implications for a lot of all your students, right? And that's the concern is, like, if we mess this up, we're messing it up. We can put ourselves in liability for all of our students. And so I think it's really a communication issue. And I know the memo came out and that came out clearly, but I think it is finding out where did this come from and then going to the source to correct it versus making it a...
Well, but I do think that has happened. I mean, Ben has communicated, the superintendent has communicated, the authorities on this issue in the state are Ben Cannon and Rob Saxton, and they have been clear, and they have issued written guidance, and Ben directly emailed all of the financial aid directors in the state, including the financial aid director that denied the student 2 days ago. So that, I mean, the communication is clear, and I think there's a point at which we have to trust Rob Saxton and Nancy Golden and the governor and Ben that they have the authority to make this guidance, and it just is unfortunate that that doesn't seem to be. But I realize we're beating a dead horse. I apologize. I'm frustrated. Anything else on this topic?
Yes, but I'm going to try to track down the other person at the U.S. Department of Education.
I'm sending everyone right.
Can I just, one more thing, because it is important, because we heard there was this other person, and there was a core of four people that Sarah Drinkwater and even myself was talking to. So you said that, well, someone called someone, and all that called someone. Who's someone? Because when we talked to those individuals, our contacts, they weren't even aware of, well, who did they call? And we're like, I don't know, someone. Everyone calls them someone. So it's important. Get a name, get a title, get a phone number, and then we can actually make the call directly and say, hey, there's some disparity here between the message. What's, you know, what's going on? Because it was difficult for us to try to follow up on who's this other person that was outside of this core four that we were talking to.
And I do think it's another conversation, because with the folks that I met with, I emailed them about the concerns and sent the letter, and they said that someone within OPE was having a conversation with the state of Oregon, but the state of Oregon hadn't gotten back to them yet. And so I sent that to Sarah, and Sarah kind of checked with everyone. She's like, well, we don't know who that is. So I asked the U.S. Department of Ed, who is the state of Oregon? Like, who? So I think there's a conversation loop that might be happening not out of Washington, D.C., but out of Seattle, that's maybe not an appropriate conversation loop, that it would maybe be better if that communication was going through Ben Cannon and the folks in D.C. that make the policy, rather than people on the ground and people in Seattle that interpret the way that policy has been in the past. But you, Susan, you might have a name?
Yeah.
Okay. Would you help, Jan? Great.
Yeah.
Thanks.
This is Danielle Sheldrake again. I was just looking, and we were talking, Matt was talking about SILA essential skills and some of those components that just came out. So we just got our Lever data report. I look at Laura because I'll be turning that into her.
I just turned it on before coming over here.
I know. It was like I had been on there this morning and it showed back up with a red light. We just got our Lever data, which has special ed graduation.
Lever, like leaving. I was thinking of a lever.
They leave the system. And we just got our updated special ed Lever information around cohort data for graduation. And, you know, Derek had come a couple months ago and shared that and said, you know, there really hasn't, you know, students with disabilities are graduating fine even with the diploma changes and the essential skills. Well, so our data has taken a pretty huge drop, and it's the data when the writing essential skills came into components, so it's 12-13, so it's a year behind. So we'll get this year's data next May, maybe earlier, hopefully. It may be good to come back and look at this, because I think one of the things we were concerned about and thinking about kids even being able to access federal financial aid, they got to graduate, and our data's looking bad. And we predicted that with the change in the essential skills requirements in Oregon for this specific population, and it's starting to happen. And our dropout rate is going up and all of those pieces, so I think we should have them come back and take a look at that.
Matt, could we do your piece at the next meeting since we're kind of out of time?
Oh, yeah,
is
absolutely.
That okay?
Yes, because
I'm sorry.
I probably don't have time either, but there's an IEP meeting, ironically, that I can't miss. or it'll create a lot of work if I do.
Is there anything else for the good of the order? Thank you again to the panel. That was really helpful and fantastic. And to everybody for continuing to come. Bridget?
Just a quick question. Do we know, like, are we going to be continuing meeting through the summer? What is our longevity on this so that our calendars try to stay flexible?
Your report in July, is that what we decided?
Right. But I don't think anything happens to us if our report is late. So we can send a report to House of Senate Ed that says we're still working on it and we're running late.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you.